Welcome to Scaring America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Well, we're coming to you on the eve of Passover, a very profoundly important holiday in the Jewish calendar. It is an event that commemorates the liberation of the people of Israel from enslavement in Egypt. And it is an apt moment to reflect on what is happening to the people of Israel as we speak. Potentially a kind of enslavement or worse, mass murder at the hands of assorted enemies led by the nation of Iran. Sadly, we're going to be talking about the latest evidence that the government of the United States is aiding and abetting Israel's enemies, not supporting fully and appropriately its ally, the state of Israel. It is always, when we're talking about these subjects, important to take stock of what's going on with my friend, my colleague, my mentor in many respects with respect to the Middle East. His name is Dr. David Wormser. He is the director of the Mideast program at our Center for Security Policy. He is a profoundly informed and authoritative analyst of what is going on. And you can follow his work at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. In fact, more importantly, let me just appeal to you to support Dr. David Wormser's work at the center. There's a button at centerforsecuritypolicy.org for donations. This program, among other things, but especially the research and analysis of colleagues like David, depend essentially on that kind of support. And I hope you'll take this to heart as an opportunity to give back in some measure to what we receive graciously from David week upon week. Thank you for joining us once again, my friend. Welcome back under the circumstances not only of this high holy day, but also the latest development in what I consider to be the serial betrayal of Israel by the Biden administration. Talk to us a little bit about it.
Yeah, well, what we see is this administration, every time they do something that is mildly pro-Israeli, and I put that on parentheses because every pro-Israeli action they take is basically one more way they try to strap Israel down to the ground. For example, the aid. Let's take the aid just very quickly. $24 billion was just passed, which is wonderful. But of that, $9.5 billion goes to the Palestinian Strait, which is why they wanted it so much. And the remaining 60% of that aid goes to Israel to buy American weapons. They can't just use it. So, but then the United States turns around, and whether it's Iran, whether it's Gaza, whether it's Lebanon, they tell the Israelis, we're going to let you buy our weapons, but you're not allowed to use them. So we stop them from winning in Gaza. We stop them from winning in Lebanon. We stop them from responding to 400 missiles against Iran. So essentially, it's a way of being pro-Israeli without being pro-Israeli. And at the same time, we're releasing tens of billions of dollars to the Iranians to arm and arm all of Israel's enemies. So, you know, one has to take that. Now, the actual behavior of this administration is nothing short now of systematic harassment and sabotage of Israel's ability to defend itself. And the latest form of that is what appears to be the application of the Leahy Law, saying that Israel violates human rights and we will sanction various units of Israel's military for that. They chose, of all units, an Orthodox unit. It is not particularly different than any other unit other than it's being Orthodox and Orthodox Jewish, religious. It actually has a lower level at this point of any suspicious or controversial incidents than other units. So really, the only thing that explains this is they knew that attacking a religious unit would be easier. It's a continuation in their base of the war on religion, too. So but it's
so
very
David, don't skip over that. That's such an important point. You're talking about the Biden administration's general hostility towards people of faith, hence, among other things, the attacks on Christian nationalists with the FBI and others in the vanguard. But you're also suggesting that by going after this ultra-Orthodox unit, and by the way, that's not all that common in the Israeli military, or at least it hasn't been to this point. Is that right? And what are the implications within the Israeli political context of their doing so?
Well, it's, I don't know, self-defeating is one of the things. It's the administration has been working with Israel's opposition to oust the Israeli government. And the issue they've chosen to focus on, which is most inconvenient for the prime minister, is the issue of the Orthodox being drafted into the military. Most Orthodox have an exemption, which is, under the current security circumstances, really rankling non-Orthodox Israelis who have to bear the burden. So there's a great push to draft all the Orthodox into the military like everybody else in Israel. And there's currently a lot of discussion on how to do that. But it's very difficult.
The point is that I guess is obvious, but just to make it clear, the Orthodox have had an exemption from military service out of some concern for their religious antipathy towards war, or
Israel's specific case, what it was is that early on when Israel was created, Ben-Gurion saw there were only about 5 or 10,000 Orthodox Jews left in Israel after the Holocaust. And he understood that they were the sort of protectors, the core of really carrying forward rigorous Jewish thought. So he thought if he gives the yeshivas, the schools, the religious schools, the exemption, you can do that instead of military service, you're serving the Jewish people, because the soul of the Jewish people also has to be protected. And with the eradication of those communities in the Holocaust, it's better they study Torah. There's enough, you know, and there were only 5 to 10,000. Now it's 17% of the population. So now it becomes a big, and Israel has a huge defense burden ahead of it in manpower. So it changes the dynamic, and that has to be revisited. It's one of those many issues that simply the creation of the state is OBE, and they have to now reinvent Israel as they become a real country.
So this is a reform that is now underway under the Netanyahu government. This unit that existed with people presumably volunteering to serve because they didn't have to is now being pilloried. And we'll talk more about that in a moment.
Yeah.
But David, just so I'm clear, this is another of Benjamin Netanyahu's reforms that the Biden administration is interested in manipulating against his government?
Correct. It's trying to oust it because the coalition that rules, Netanyahu's coalition, includes religious Orthodox parties who are negotiating this. And obviously they are very, they didn't really want them to be drafted in if they are under their terms. So it's a very delicate thing. And all of a sudden, here you have a unit where you have thousands of Orthodox conscribed into the military. And all of a sudden, they're under attack from the United States and sanctioned. And it puts the government and the opposition, by the way, in a terrible place, because you're telling these kids, you've got to go into the military, and then they have to defend them against the United States. You can't just leave them twisting in the trenches. So this is self-defeating in the end. But it really has to do with religion. It's war on religion. That's the only thing that makes this unit different is it's religious.
Yeah. David, we're coming back to the sanctions and what they would entail of not just for this unit, but for the Israeli military and for the war effort as well. Yeah. On the other side of this very short break, folks, I hope you'll stay tuned for more with Dr. David Wurmser right after this.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The bad news is that Columbia University and other campuses across America are under siege. The worst news is that a growing number of the perpetrators are calling for death to America, and mean it literally. They're backed by communist and Islamist organizations comprising the aptly named Red Green Axis, including the Muslim Brotherhood. According to a secret plan seized from that organization's archives 20 years ago and introduced into evidence by the U.S. government during the nation's largest terrorism finance trial, the Muslim Brothers seek to destroy the United States. This explanatory memorandum describes their mission in America as a, quote, kind of grand jihad in eliminating and destroying Western civilization from within, unquote. The Muslim Brotherhood and its communist allies are enemies domestic, and those who have sworn an oath to defend our Constitution against them must do so now. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Dr. David Wormser is in the house. I'm very pleased to say we're continuing our conversation about an impending decision, we're told, by Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, to impose sanctions on a very important unit in the Israeli Defense Force. It is made up of ultra-Orthodox Jews, and it is deeply engaged at the moment in combat operations, both in Gaza and across the northern border with Hezbollah, and even on the Golan Heights, defending Israel against assaults from all of those quarters. Apparently, the charges against this unit arise from its presence in trying to defend Israelis on what is widely called the West Bank, actually historically Judea and Samaria. And David, what are the nature of the charges that have been raised, and what are the likely impacts of these sanctions?
The charges in a nutshell is this is 2 years ago, January 2022, there was an elderly man, an 80-year-old, coming back from a wedding in the West Bank. There had been terrorist attacks, and there was a roadblock by the IDF, by this unit, and they stopped him. The man was unresponsive in terms of cooperation, and he was arrested and put on the side of the road for the meantime. And he was quite drunk. So the Israelis eventually, after about half an hour, released him. And they thought that he was falling asleep because he was so drunk, so they left him there. There were some others around, so they thought he'd be okay. And the man died, and the Israelis are accused of killing him. Now, the office, this was some sort of form of negligence, so the IDF investigated this, like all units in the IDF. It's under investigation. They have a very robust internal the lawyers, the legal corps is very powerful in the Israeli military. And the officers were reprimanded. Some lost their rank. Some were thrown out of the military. So punishments were meted out. And that was the end of it. But the United States, under the instigation of an organization that has ties to Iran and has the connections to the Human Rights Bureau at the State Department, has focused on this unit and this issue and this event. And they've been pounding the Israelis on it ever since, even though there has been an internal investigation and punishments. And that is what's driving the sanctions, that one incident.
I want to talk more about this group in a moment, David, but what you're saying sounds as though it is something that the Biden administration constantly complains about Israel engaging in, if I'm not mistaken, collective punishment. This sounds completely inappropriate. And talk a little bit about the magnitude of the sanctions that are now in prospect here.
Well, the magnitude of the sanctions are that all U.S. weapons to this unit have to be halted. Any unit transferring weapons to this unit, which would mean Israel's Central Logistical Corps, would be sanctioned if they transfer anything to this unit. Any unit that trains with this unit will be sanctioned. And now this is an integrated unit in the Israeli military, which is fighting in Gaza with the Air Force. So theoretically, this opens the door for the universal sanctioning of the Israeli military. The other thing is what we're hearing is that several units now are under consideration. This is a test case. I think it was a test case by the administration because they see Jewish opposition through the lens of radical left progressive Jewish communities that they have support from. It's the New York Times crowd. And the New York Times crowd is waging war against Orthodox Jews in New York. So what you're seeing is they thought it was safe to go and use the orthodoxy of this unit to go after it because they thought most of the Jewish community wouldn't support that, wouldn't support the unit. And once you've established the precedent of dipping into the Israeli military and sanctioning whole units and their officers with capability of arrest upon entry in the United States, you've opened the door then for going unit by unit by unit. And I think the goal here is any unit that serves in the West Bank will be eventually sanctioned. And that way the United States redefines Israel's defense force as an Israeli occupation force that is under sanction as long as they remain in the West Bank. It's a way to force them out.
David, it's hard to overstate the implications of this then, it sounds to me. What you're talking about is disarming a unit in the fight in critical places. And by the way, folks, just to be absolutely clear about this, the fight is not narrowly over whether Israel is going to go into Rafah or not. The fight is over whether Israel will survive the possible loss being meted to it, it seems, by the United States in Gaza, to say nothing of being disallowed to do something about the threat that Hezbollah now represents, and even more to the point that Iran behind all of them represents. And again, I just don't understand how a nation that overwhelmingly supports Israel, and I believe that continues to describe this country, is having a government that is so set on, at best, hamstringing the Jewish state, and at worst, imperiling it. And I just want you to wrap this up, David, by talking a little bit about this group called Dawn, mm-hmm. that apparently is the prime mover behind these sanctions on this American ally.
Yes, it's headed by a lady. Her name is Whitson, Miss Whitson. And there was a guy who was a director of political military affairs, a senior position at State Department, the one who runs all the weapons deals through the State Department, resigned in protest of weapon sales to Israel and went to this organization. Whitson was with Trita Parsi, who's really an Iranian agent, at the Quincy Institute, which is funded. It really is an Iranian front with some angle of a Russian front as well, the Quincy Institute. And she was the head of its Middle East division. She now heads this new organization, Dawn, and the State Department Director of Political Military Affairs has joined her, and they're working with the, quote, resistance in the State Department to essentially shut down Israel's military and force a choice that Israel leaves the West Bank or its entire military becomes sanctioned eventually with all its officers unable to travel for fear of arrest. It drives war crimes tribunals against the military. And, of course, without the West Bank, October 7th would happen from the West Bank and Israel would be destroyed. So in essence, this is the beginning of a war to destroy Israel by the resistance at the State Department and its allies outside, all of which are taking their directives from Tehran.
Now, David, this comes on top of a decision by the Congress over the weekend to allocate $9 billion to what seems to be effectively Hamas, albeit in the form of humanitarian assistance. Talk about that in this same context. Is this more of an effort to destroy Israel and with the help of Republicans in Congress, no less?
The opposition to going into Rafiah implies that we accept Hamas surviving as a government in Gaza for a third of Gaza instead of all of Gaza, but nevertheless, it has a remaining presence in Gaza. And then we funnel nearly $9.5 billion, $9.4 billion to it, which we know what Hamas does with the money. This is an unprecedented amount of money for Hamas. For anybody, to anybody. And Hamas, we know, will turn this into rebuilding its military capability to attack Israel again, as well as into a capability to finally complete its takeover of the West Bank politics as well. So Israel will then face two fronts.
Well, two or four, I'm counting four myself, between Gaza, Lebanon,
units
and Iran.
Protect Israel from that very Hamas are disarmed.
Being sanctioned, being disarmed. David, this is heartbreaking, especially on the eve of Passover. I wish you a good holiday, my friend, fast, as they say, and we'll look forward to talking to you on the other side with updates on all of this. God bless you, my friend. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. It's my pleasure to say we have with us a man who's become a great friend as well as a member of our Center for Security Policy Board of Directors. His name is Bill Walton. You probably know him best for his appearances here, yes, but also on his own television program, The Bill Walton Show. He is a recovering master of the universe, I'm fond of saying, having been a leading executive on Wall Street. And then he saw the light and came to the conservative side very, very impressively. Now, he serves as the vice chairman of the Conservative Political Action Coalition, a formidable group, best known for its conferences, one of which is taking place, as we speak, this week in Hungary, part of their outreach program to conservatives worldwide and leadership of that movement, I believe. Bill, we have a chance to talk about a couple of important things with you, in which you and CPAC have become really leading forces. One was, I think an outstanding press conference. I'm a little not quite impartial on it because I was in it, but it was a very impressive display of both congressional concern as well as that of leaders of the conservative movement, including your colleague, the chairman of CPAC, Matt Schlapp, about this World Health Organization, set of treaties heading down the pike towards us at warp speed, if I can use that expression. The end of next month. I want to talk with you a little bit about that and some highlights of that press conference, including a new poll by John McLaughlin. Tell us a little bit about your perspective on where things stand at the moment, Bill.
Well, you know, we're fighting a multiple front war to preserve our freedom and sovereignty in the United States. And with what's happening with the World Health Organization, we're actually fighting a battle here that we can win. We've talked about this before, but there's been a movement by the World Health Organization, guided by all the other international globalist players, to make the World Health Organization arrangement move from voluntary to mandatory, which would give them the right to declare emergencies, really at the behest of the president, Tedros, who's a handpicked protege of President Xi of China. And, you know, the thing about this, Frank, is this is not just about health. This is about a much, much broader agenda. And if you look inside the agreements that they're putting together, it's about climate change. It's about diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's about racial justice. It's about every single wish list on the UN's 2030 agenda and their 2025 agenda and whatever other names they have for their plans to take away our freedom. And in this case, we've got a date. They're going to meet beginning in May 28th. I believe they're meeting in 27th. Well, that's your department. But they're going to be meeting in, of course, the beautiful Geneva, overlooking Lake Geneva. International bureaucrats always only can meet in gorgeous places. And they want to bring together this agreement and get 196 signatures, well, from the participating countries. And CPAC, our last conference, was called Where Globalism Goes to Die. And we have sponsored conferences in Hungary, Japan, Mexico, Israel, a whole list of countries. There's a freedom movement that's worldwide. And so we're not only enlisting people here in the United States to fight this, but also in all these other countries. And we've got a conference in Hungary, I believe it starts next week, where this is going to be front and center. Hmm.
I thought it was actually this week, but whenever it is, it's an important opportunity for the people of Hungary to join in a very public way this growing movement. There was a massive demonstration in Japan.
It's Thursday, Frank. I've got it. Yeah. I got my dates.
Yeah. No, right. I think it was last week, but now it's upon us. And as I say, Bill, I think it's exciting that Viktor Orban, the prime minister of Hungary, of course, is a champion of an anti-globalist program. And it would be wonderful if one of the things that comes out of CPAC in Hungary is evidence that we have yet another important country in Europe standing up. The Dutch have done so just last week. And we need more and more of them to be saying two things, really. One of them is, first, for sure, for us at least, two things. One is, do not formally approve these two treaties at the end of May. They're not ready for prime time. We're still not being read in on what's in them. And the idea seems to be to try to conceal it pretty much right up until the last moment. I'm told there's a new draft of the so-called International Health Regulations Amendments that's just been leaked, but it's still a long way from the kind of transparency that we need. Bill, to say nothing of the fact that the World Health Organization's own regulations say you need to give people 4 months to read and study and debate and otherwise address these amendments before they can be approved. I don't understand how this is even still in prospect.
Well, Frank, you're shocked that they're not paying attention to the rule of law and international agreements to work their agenda. Why would they hear when they don't do it anyplace else? The thing that we have to realize is this is not something being done to the United States. This is being driven by the Biden administration. And, you know, there are three players in the administration. There are many of them, but the key ones are Assistant Secretary at HHS for Global Affairs, Lois Pace, and Ambassador John Nikinasong, State Department's USAID AIDS coordinator, and also Dr. Atul Gawande, who's at the, he is at the Assistant Administrator for Global Health. So, and this sounds like a fairly internationalist crew. It is. Lois is an interesting person. She's been a fighter for, as she describes it, making sure that black and brown people have access to health service. In other words, she's a racial justice warrior, and she's interested in topics, and this is out. She's racial health justice, decolonializing global health. And so this is the cultural Marxist agenda on steroids. And this is a battle we can fight and win. We need to get the Senate to do its job and step up and say, we're not going to enter into. Yeah. And we can, but we've got to shine a light on this issue and make it very painful for people that don't support it. I don't see even if you're a Democrat senator, you would want to cede our entire healthcare sovereignty. It's a toxic issue politically. Our pollster, John McLaughlin, has polled this, and Americans overwhelmingly favor having Senate ratification of something like this, and they're against giving up healthcare sovereignty to an international organization. This is a winning issue politically.
It sure is, and it's galling that still so few of us are aware of what's going on here. And it's one of the things that our Sovereignty Coalition bill, of which you're an important member, will be mounting what we call an emergency campaign to defend America's sovereignty. And people can find more about that at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. That'll take you to the Sovereignty Coalition and sovereignticoalition.org. Join us there, folks, if you can, if you have not already done so. This is absolutely imperative. Yeah. It's one of the things I'm extremely proud of our center for doing, Bill, with our colleague Reggie Littlejohn of Women's Rights Without Frontiers, and an incredible array of extremely talented medical practitioners, attorneys, subject matter experts, a few national security folks like us. But it's really vital that people become engaged. It's 34 days from today that this is going to go down if we are not able to persuade senators, among others, I would say John Tester and Sherrod Brown from red states like Montana and Ohio, respectively, that they don't want to be on the wrong side of this issue. And if those two can be peeled off, I think that we'll find that there's a lot of others that are probably going to be pretty uncomfortable with this as well. But it comes down to, and this is where we so appreciate your leadership at CPAC. Thanks to your efforts in the meeting here in Washington a few months ago, your board actually adopted this as a priority. Tell us a little bit more about that, Bill, if you would.
Well, we had three resolutions we passed, and this was one of the key ones. The other, of course, was supporting Israel, and the third one I don't recollect. But this was a big part of our meeting last month. And when you talk about people, well, yes, and you know, CPAC is as I said, we're no longer just. You know, yes, we are America first, but we're also in a way Hungary first and Israel first and all countries right to sovereignty. And so the thing I think we need to talk about is, what are we trying to achieve here? We basically at this point want to delay this. We can't kill it completely. That's just not practical, but we can get it delayed. And of course, the goal here is to have it delayed until we have a Trump administration that would be in a very different mode negotiating this. In fact, as we recollect, Trump left the World Health Organization, which is what we should be doing. I mean, let's remember the track record of the World Health Organization during the COVID crisis was abysmal. Every single recommendation they made was wrong.
And Bill, it was all at the hands of Tedros Ghebreyesus. Yeah, it's at the hands of Tedros Ghebreyesus, who they intend to empower further. It's just madness. Bill, thank you for your leadership on all this. Watch the Bill Walton Show, and I know you'll come back to us next week. Thank you, my friend. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned.
is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The bad news is that Columbia University and other campuses across America are under siege. The worst news is that a growing number of the perpetrators are calling for death to America, and mean it literally. They're backed by communist and Islamist organizations comprising the aptly named Red Green Axis, including the Muslim Brotherhood. According to a secret plan seized from that organization's archives 20 years ago and introduced into evidence by the U.S. government during the nation's largest terrorism finance trial, the Muslim Brothers seek to destroy the United States. This explanatory memorandum describes their mission in America as a, quote, kind of grand jihad in eliminating and destroying Western civilization from within, unquote. The Muslim Brotherhood and its communist allies are enemies domestic, and those who have sworn an oath to defend our Constitution against them must do so now. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Gordon Chang is in the house. This makes it a red letter day here at Securing America. Gordon G. Chang is a man to be followed, that name on Twitter or X if you would prefer. He is the author of a number of extraordinarily important books. A personal favorite of mine is The Coming Collapse of China. He is an essayist of an extraordinary productivity at places like Newsweek and the Gatestone Institute. And he graces this show as often as he can, for which I am profoundly grateful. It's good to have you back, Gordon. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Frank. And I'm profoundly grateful.
Well, you're very kind. Let me start, Gordon, by asking you, I've got three topics that I want to try to cover in an all too limited amount of time. The first has to do with something that you have been warning about for years. And a select committee of the House of Representatives has just basically confirmed everything you've been saying. And we've just seen the House of Representatives, I think, beginning to talk about this as well, more generally, not just their committee. That is the fentanyl crisis, as it's called. More accurately described, it seems, as China's chemical warfare against America using fentanyl. Talk a little bit about both the magnitude of this problem, the damage that it's doing, and the evidence that the Chinese Communist Party is enabling it, not a partner in trying to help constrain it.
About 70 to 80,000 Americans each year die from doses of illegal Chinese fentanyl. And the story here is that, as you point out, the Communist Party does this as attacks us with fentanyl as an integral part of its plan to take down the United States. You know, Xi Jinping and President Biden on November 15th of last year, they talked about fentanyl. The day after, Biden bragged that he got the Chinese to promise to significantly reduce the flow of fentanyl precursors and pill presses from China to the Western Hemisphere. But that promise really was essentially the same as Xi Jinping made to President Trump in 2018 and to President Obama before then. And we know that fentanyl producers, many of them are state-owned. They operate in China's near-total surveillance state, which means that the party knows about what they're doing and therefore has to approve of it. Chinese diplomats give cover to the gangs. Every container that leaves China is inspected by officials. The fentanyl gangs launder their proceeds through the Chinese state banking system. And 5 months after the Xi Biden meeting, we know that China is still continuing with its subsidies for the production and export of fentanyl. The only thing we can really conclude is that this is a murder of Americans. And Biden, one other point, Biden knows what's going on. He has the power to stop it and has chosen not to do so. And Americans should be outraged at the Chinese, but they should be more outraged at their own politicians who are elected to defend them.
Yeah. And that it's being done on this scale, and the scale continues, as I understand it, to grow. I've heard numbers as high as 100,000, Gordon, but whatever it is, it's utterly unacceptable. especially if, as you have confirmed, this is a witting, purposeful attack on America. And it, as you've also indicated, is part and parcel of not just their unrestricted warfare, but their people's war for destroying this country. I salute you for the clarity you've brought to this for years, as I say, and for leading in the effort to try to hold China accountable for it. As we argue in our book, The Indictment, Gordon, to which you contributed through your many appearances in our Committee on the Present Danger China webinars, these are indictable offenses, and the prosecution should proceed forthwith, at a minimum, in the court of public opinion. Let me turn to another topic that is also ominous, Gordon, and that is what the Chinese are doing in the South China Sea. Specifically, you've been raising the alarm about this vis-a-vis our ally, our treaty ally, no less, the Philippines. I understand, and you tweeted about it in your excellent tweet, and I commend it to everyone again. Gordon G. Chang is the place to follow, Gordon. Kyle Bass had a note that you retweeted talking about the CCP making it absolutely clear that they are going to take the second Thomas Shoal. Remind us what that is and what the implications of it would be if they were to do that.
Second Thomas Shoal is a reef which is about 125 or so nautical miles from the main Philippine islands, about 700 nautical miles from the closest Chinese feature, which is Hainan Island. It is clearly part of the Philippines. It's in the Philippines' exclusive economic zone. And China there has been using some very belligerent tactics, including injuring Philippine sailors, four of them on March 5, with water cannon. The Chinese have been ramming. They have made it very clear that they want Second Thomas Shoal, as they want about 85% of the South China Sea, which they claim is blue national soil, or other words, territorial water. That claim is ludicrous. A tribunal convened under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea actually ruled in favor of the Philippines in 2016. The story here, of course, is that John Kerry, when he was Secretary of State, he just wasn't very enthusiastic about enforcing that ruling. The problem is that the Biden administration has been issuing warning after warning. The State Department has issued about 9 written warnings in Biden's era to China that we're prepared to use force to defend our treaty ally, the Philippines. Biden himself has made oral warnings to the same effect, the most recent on the 11th of this month. And really, the Chinese are just ignoring it, which shows you that deterrence has failed. And of course, we are seeing some very important tactics on the part of the Chinese. On Monday, a week ago, China swarmed 55 vessels in Philippine waters in the South China Sea.
Gordon, we have to take a very short break. When we come back, I want to ask you about the composition of that fleet and what it means if perhaps even a single Philippine sailor is killed in this aggressive behavior. What it means for the Philippines, of course, but also what it would mean for us. Gordon G. Chang is in the house. We are honored to have him with us always, and very appreciative of his leadership in these various areas. You'll want to find out what he's going to say next. Stay tuned. We're back. Gordon G. Chang is with us once again. We're delighted, as always, to be able to pick his considerable brains about what is up with China at the moment. And Gordon, again, you've been presciently warning that this day was coming, going back years to the Obama administration when Joe Biden had the portfolio of trying to prevail upon the Chinese not to build these, I think of them as bastion islands all over the South China Sea, which is now reinforcing its claims to those as territorial waters. But talk a little bit about this fleet of Chinese vessels that descended upon the Philippines recently in this proximity, I guess, to the Second Thomas Shoal. What kinds of vessels, what are they up to, and what is the likelihood that there will be conflict as a result of all of this?
Yeah, a week ago Monday, I mentioned there were 55 Chinese vessels in the South China Sea in Philippine waters. Most of those, there were blue, white, and gray hulls, as they say. Blue hulls are the maritime militia, which was the small boats, and that was by far the majority of China's vessels. But there were also about 10 or so white hulls, Coast Guard ships. Those Coast Guard ships are basically frigates. And there was actually one gray hull, the People's Liberation Army Navy. So it was the range of China's assets in the South China Sea.
And is it safe to say that all of those are armed, even those blue hulls?
All of them are armed. The blue hulls are armed with light weaponry, machine guns, and they're supposed to be fishing vessels, but really they are part of the Chinese military force because they operate in coordination with it. And so really we should be treating them as one.
Yeah. And these are obviously numbers of vessels that would pose a challenge to the Philippine Navy, and for that matter, I suppose the U.S. Navy, if it were in those waters, just by sheer mass. Gordon, it's been said, I believe, by a senior U.S. commander that we are one, murder, I guess you'd call it, by a Chinese vessel of a Philippine sailor away from having our treaty obligations kick in here to defend the Philippines. I think actually this has been part of the message that's been sent by other administration officials too. Is that in prospect, do you think?
Well, because the Chinese tactics have become more belligerent, I think it is safe to say that we are one death away from conflict in the South China Sea. And if there were to be a war in the South China Sea, I think we need to start talking about this as a global conflict, because there is war in Ukraine. There is basically insurgencies, which are wars in North Africa. There's war in the Middle East. All of these wars, China is fighting. So China's fighting proxy wars on three continents right now. And if we were to have a conflict in East Asia, I think you have to say that that is global war. In the 1930s, there were wars separate around the world, and they merged into what we now call World War II. And we are seeing the same dynamic today because there is an almost irresistible momentum to global conflict. You know, people will say, oh, this is just regional or whatever. It's not, because China and Russia are fighting either directly or indirectly around the world. Every conflict has global implications. And that's what makes what's going on in the South China Sea so dangerous right now.
Yeah. Well, Gordon, as you know, I'm fond of calling this strategic arson by Xi Jinping, whether it's with his Russian limited partner or whether it's with the Iranians and, their proxies, or whether it's now quite possibly one or more conflicts in the Southern Pacific, to say nothing of the possibilities we've discussed before of something going sideways at their hands here in the United States as well. I call this World War Xi. And in fact, we're doing a series of programs. I know you can't make the first one, which is now scheduled for the 15th of May, I believe, in Atlanta, Georgia. We're going to be doing them in a number of other states around the country. And I think you're in principle going to be joining us if we can schedule it with your busy schedule, Gordon. But this is a really important time to be assessing exactly what you say, which is that this is not a series of isolated events. This is a global war brought to us, I believe, by Xi Jinping. Let me turn quickly to one other topic, another very dangerous development at the hands of Xi and his friends among the global elite, including Joe Biden. And that would be this idea of having the United States, among other nations, surrender our sovereignty and our, well, I would argue, our states' rights and our individual medical freedoms to a new tyranny under one of their handpicked proxies, Tedros Ghebreyesus of the World Health Organization. We talked a little bit about this with Bill Walton a moment ago, but I'd be very interested in your thoughts as to how does this fit into the larger Chinese designs to dominate the planet?
Well, China dominates the World Health Organization. And, you know, we know this from what happened in January of 2020. The WHO on January 9th issued a statement saying that based upon the information they received from China, that SARS-CoV-2, the pathogen that caused COVID-19, was not readily transmissible. They compounded the crime on the 14th of that month by issuing a tweet, World WHO tweet, saying the same thing. This was disarming basically health authorities around the world, saying, don't worry about this. But Chinese authorities, of course, knew that this was highly contagious. And the doctors at the WHO knew it was highly contagious. And we know this because they actually said that, and I believe it was April of 2020, when Maria von Kerkhoff, among others, said that when she had first heard about COVID-19, she knew that this was like a virus that was highly contagious because she was a MERS specialist, and that was a related disease.
It was the Chinese Communist Party line, though, that he was towing. And this is so important, Gordon, because, as you know, that is almost certainly what he would be doing in the future, except with compulsory powers, not just advisory ones. Thank you for your leadership on this, as so many other issues, Gordon. We look forward to our next visit with you soon. In the meantime, stay well. You're a national treasure. Gordon G. Chang is where you can follow him. And centerforsecuritypolicy.org is where you can follow us. We'll be right. We will talk to you again next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.